When I announced this sermon and went to coordinate with Judy, she asked if this was going to be about Kermit. And I said no. And, of course, it is at some level about Kermit because frogs are dying and frogs are being born with two and three heads and without legs, and the tadpoles aren't becoming real frogs. We have some issues with Mother Nature. And actually, Mother Nature may have some issues with us. The second hymn could not have been more appropriate in talking about this garden. If skeptics are looking for some indication of God's fallibility as opposed to infallibility, you don't have to wait very long in Scripture. All you have to do is get a third of the way through Genesis 1. When God gives dominion of the earth, of the creatures in the sea, the birds in the air, all that creepeth and crawleth and swimmeth and flieth, gives dominion of these things to them. The them being Adam and Eve, and therefore presumably human beings. In my view, and the view of many, we have not done a very good job of tending the garden. It seems to have been a real bad piece of management on God's part. It is like God has turned over the keys to the car to a 12-year-old who has been out joyriding with Mother Nature, completely unconscious and unconcerned about the fumes that are spewing, the cost, the danger of driving heavy machinery while under the influence of hormones. I mean, our medications warn us not to operate heavy machinery. What is it about this once blue yet still beautiful marble that we are driving through space that we think that we can just go on automatic pilot and do anything that we want to do without any regards to the cost? The cost to everyone of not caring about this world and taking care of the world. When issues come up about being green, about what should we be doing about this, humanity seems to be divided almost equally, those who think about it, and there's a category that doesn't and shouldn't, but I'll get to that, between denial and hysteria. Nothing's wrong, and somebody else will fix it, or we're doomed, we're all going to die. Neither one of those two options actually leads to constructive engagement with the problems, and just leaves us doing what we are doing, and the only difference it makes which side one picks in those fatal alternatives is whether you're going to do what you're doing happy or really depressed. The results are the same. Nothing gets done to change what we are doing to the earth, to the oceans, to the skies, to our resources. And we really should be concerned with this and make some changes. It's time to pay attention to the mileage. It's time to pay attention to the quality of life, of air and of water, and the presence of air and water and food. When we look at how the world deals with the great questions of ecology, part of the world is very poor and very hungry. And, you know, they don't have the same options we do about worrying about spotted owls and gorillas in the mist. If my family were starving, if my tribe were starving, I would not be an ecologist. I might not be responsible for the mess that was going on because there have been northern European and European powers that have come into rainforests and into jungles and created some of the scarcity. But on the day-to-day basis, I will poach a spotted owl to feed my child. So I don't blame the poor for being poor and trying to stay alive and to think about themselves and their family. I do hold them to a different standard because of the reality of life and death and how they live. There's a huge segment, however, of humanity that just doesn't care. It may even want to profit from the degradation of the environment. But basically, and I had this discussion honestly and truly with somebody this week, a good and apparently decent human being with college degrees and achievements in life, and this person said, look, I know the ecology is important, and I know, John, that what you say is right, and we really could get 75, 85, 95 miles to the gallon without having to change any technology, just build smaller, lighter cars and be willing to go 45 miles an hour instead of 85 miles an hour. But this person said, you know, that's just an awful long trip to San Francisco at 45 miles an hour, and I'm not willing to do that in a 1,000-pound car. I thought that there should be a teachable moment, but I couldn't find it. I looked, no teachable moment there, because the bottom line was, I want to change results without changing anything that I do. Every therapist has heard this. Every person who has ever been on a diet knows this, because I want to keep eating and I want to lose weight. I want to lose weight in my sleep. I want there to be clean air and clean water, and I don't want to change anything that I do. I'd like to change some things that you do. Would you please, would you do something about your carbon footprint? So America says to India and to China, your carbon footprint is too big. It's still much smaller than ours, but it's too big. You're spewing stuff into the skies. And a lot of good people say, you know, I'm not willing to change anything that I do, because why should I be held to a stricter standard than the people in Africa, or the people in Asia, the people in Latin America? And there's actually, in my view, a good answer to that. We had 125 years of technology and spewing everything we wanted to spew into the air and dumping everything we wanted to dump into the rivers and into the lakes and into the sea. And now we're saying, well, we're fine. We're post-technological. We don't actually make anything here. And so we'd like you to raise your economies and your standards. But for God's sakes, you need to be much more ecologically sensitive than we were when we got to this position. That doesn't play so well out in the world, and it's not going to work as a strategy for us. Whether or not we think that it is cosmically the right thing, it's not the politically and economically possible thing. Yes, we are all going to get an object lesson in smog for those who watch the Olympics in China. You have air that you can actually cut and pass out to people. There's no absence of it, but you know, in China, you actually, bad air is good for you because it's high in fiber. We're not going to do very well with that. And for people who are waiting for the rest of the world to be good until we are willing to be better, it's not a strategy that's going to work. We don't have control over them. We have some control over us. But last week, as I warned you I would, I'm going to repeat, life is an incomplete information problem. And an awful lot of the time, well-meaning people do things with terrific intentions, but we can never know the full consequences of the choices that we make, and we sometimes get stuck having made those choices and are unwilling to say, oh, whoops. Somewhere between the arrogance of the 12-year-old attitude and the humility of we don't know anything, there's a middle position of doing what we can with some modesty and being willing to turn back when something isn't working or isn't working the way that we thought that it would. The history of humanity very often is that we come up with a solution that then becomes the problem. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have come up with a solution. It means we have to be able to reevaluate. Classically, in 1909, the New York Times published an article about how pollution was finally solved, and there would be no more pollution in New York City because horses were being replaced by cars. Well, that was true. The tailpipe emissions from horses are worse than the tailpipe emissions from cars. And if you had as many horses as you have cars in this land, the population would be much smaller of human beings. And I think many of us would shuffle off this mortal coil pretty happy to escape. But the cars, which were the solution, became the problem. That's part of the history of humanity. We built nuclear power plants in the 50s. Disposal of nuclear waste became a problem. There was a reevaluation. Maybe there will be another reevaluation. I'm not taking a position on it. I'm saying we shouldn't be locked into our positions with such arrogance that we're not willing to look at the rest of the world, to look at ourselves, and to truly understand what the risks and what the gains are, and to know that some of our experiments aren't going to work. 15 years ago, on our house, we had a solar heater on for the hot water and solar heater for the swimming pool. We had an amazingly large and complex computer that was supposed to run our heating and air very efficiently. It didn't, but that's okay. Intentions count for something, results count for more, and we have to be willing to look at what we're doing. And give it the Dr. Phil test. How's that working for you? And an awful lot of the things that we do don't, after a while, pass the Dr. Phil test. The classic example is we introduce species, non-native plants and animals, into other countries and other continents, and all of a sudden, the native fish are gone, the native birds are gone. In Australia, they found that that had happened, and so they introduced rabbits to control the snakes and the rats. And somehow, these good people that brought over the rabbits could not possibly have foreseen that the rabbits would do what rabbits will do. And so the problem became the rabbits. Today's reading, the biblical passage on which I base this, I had out here. Ah, here it is. There was an old woman who swallowed a dog. What a hog to swallow a dog. She swallowed the dog to catch the cat. She swallowed the cat to catch the bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die. That's been how we have handled ecology. We replace one thing with another to fix the other problem, to fix the problem that we just put in the fix. And speaking of fixes, we do the same thing in other areas of our life. That opium poppies were really a bad idea, so they made heroin. And then they made methadone. And we have drugs to cure the drugs, to cure the drugs, to cure the drugs. And we do the same thing with ecology. It is not that we must do nothing. It is that we must proceed with some degree of humility, because we don't know how it is going to play out. I assume that the good folks of Iowa, and I'm not ready to declare war on Iowa, I have lots of fine relatives there, that the good folks of Iowa did not come up with ethanol in order to drive the price of food higher, in order to create hunger, starvation, displacement and wars throughout the Third World, and possibly at some point within the First World. I assume they didn't come up with ethanol in the hopes that other states and other countries would deforest and plant biofuels. The idea of being able to have a renewable resource for our cars was a good idea at first blush. But the consequences, like the rabbits, should have been foreseeable. That if you are moving food crops, food for humans and food for livestock, into food for cars, that the price of food is going to go up. And as the price of food goes up, this is kind of basic economics, farmers who are planting marginal crops are going to move them to money crops, and if the money is in fuel and not in calories for human beings, there are going to be consequences. At some point, you take a look and say, okay, how's that working for us, for the Third World, for food prices? It's not. It was a terrible or cynical idea, though somewhere in the system some cynicism might have been involved. It's just not thought through sufficiently. But once it gets thought through, we have to take a look and say, oh my God, what are we doing? What are we doing when we choose our cars at 85 miles an hour and a ton and a half over hungry people in this country and in the developing world? What are we doing? Not what's India doing, what's China doing, to some extent, what's going on in the Amazon, where there's deforestation because they are planting plants for biofuels in the Amazon basin. We don't need a miracle breakthrough in order to change our gas consumption. We need to be willing to do some things. We need to be willing to look at the apparently dramatic things that people do and see what is drama and what is real in terms of changing the quality of life for human beings on this planet today. It's very difficult. I read a moving sermon by a Unitarian Universalist minister who is a paragon of ecological goodness, who has the smallest carbon footprint of any human being that I have heard of in the developed world. And this Unitarian Universalist minister says, it's not enough, I am still a sinner. That's too classically religious for me. You know, I don't expect to be a saint. I don't expect others to be saints. I just want to be better. I want to be satisfied at each baby step, at each light bulb I replace, at each car change that I make that uses less, at each step that we take to be a little bit better. And when people who are utterly and completely committed do remarkable things to change their lives and are still guilty and miserable, that's no way to entice others to make the small and possible changes that just begin to reverse the degradation and begin at least a consciousness that starts with healing. My friend Al Danzig here, when he was at the Studio City Church before my time, when the Reverend Dennis Kuby was there, that's where Earth Day was invented. Dennis Kuby was one of the people that created Earth Day. At our Studio City Church, on that first Earth Day, they built a pit and they buried an internal combustion engine. That was some years ago. We have not reached nirvana yet. But we have gotten better. We have gotten better. To just say everything's a failure, we've made no progress, is to discourage ourselves and the next generation. We need to be both realistic and optimistic and engaged in doing the things that we can do and willing to change, willing to listen, willing to be living organisms with each other and learn from real life experience and not just chase every new thing that comes along. His great satire on Unitarianism, Peter DeVries and his church called People's Liberal, has a Calder Mobile up in the chancel. And he says that for the People's Liberal folks, that symbolizes their willingness to be blown about in whatever the currents of change are. I want to be responsive to change. I want to learn. I want to change. And sometimes I have to change for my change. And that means not having the arrogance of saying, this is the way, it's my way, it better be your way, or you're a bunch of rotten sinners, and you're making the whole world die. There's the middle position. And the middle position is being aware, using our knowledge to take steps that are important and resolute without being arrogant and condescending. And that's a tough line to walk. It really is. And life is an incomplete information problem. I've changed most of my light fixtures to those coils. And then I read the coils that they're filled with mercury, and if you drop one, you better call hazmat. And I don't know if I'm doing good or bad. I'm sure somebody here will tell me. I'm sure at least a couple people here will tell me exactly the opposite recommendations. That's why it's hard. That's why we have to be both open and humble and caring. Well, that gives us three both. I apologize. But it's a tough issue. And it isn't easy being green, but we have a responsibility to do the things that we can and to try to walk lightly on the earth, aware of what we use, aware of its costs to us and to the rest of the people with whom we fly this once blue, yet still beautiful marble through space.